Wayne Hanna is coming up on the podcast at Good Morning Assholes on TikTok, YouTube, Wayne Hanna. That's where he'll be putting out a lot of his content moving forward. Wayne was an artillery soldier for 20 years in the Canadian Army. At one point, he was on a military boat counteracting the Somalian pirates, and he just got so sick and tired of the morning announcements. They were dry, they were boring. He said to the person in charge, "Hey, I think I can bring a laugh to these people for 2 minutes every morning." And that's exactly what he did. For the next month and a half, he did that. And he's a humorist, a content creator, and a firefighter now. Wayne Hanna, thanks for being here. I appreciate you. Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line. Super excited to have Wayne Hanna on the podcast. Wayne is the founder and creator behind Mindfulish and Good Morning Assholes, if you've seen it on TikTok or other social medias out there. Wayne, you're a veteran from the military. You're a firefighter. You have 20 plus years in the fire service. You are a mental health advocate. And I think, Wayne, you've got like over 250,000 or something in your online community. You've also got the CD beside your name, and I looked it up. It means you're Canadian Forces. It's a decoration for 12 plus years of service. I think you've got like 20 plus of service. And I know that your journey, Wayne, has been challenging, yet rewarding. And I'm so excited to have you here with us. Thank you. I appreciate you, and thank you for being on the podcast, Wayne.
Wow. It's weird. It's weird when you hear your name like that, and then people do your accolades, and I'll ask you throughout this thing to correct my words because I say them wrong or out of context. But to hear your accolades, and then it always gets me, is it's the journey part. The journey part gets me, because I think that's my biggest accolade, is being able to still sit here amongst all the crap I've put myself through, if that makes sense, which I think it does. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Wayne. So let's take it back, Wayne, for the listener. Tell us if you got into the military first or firefighting, and how did you start your journey and career?
So before we pressed record, you had told me a little bit about your story and how you were always on this adventure to find something that excited you and gave you, you know, I read between the lines, and gives you purpose, and it aligns you with, you know, the direction you were. It aligns your legacy, essentially. And for me, I wanted to be two things since I was 3 years old, a fireman and a soldier. There was nothing else. And it's funny, because when you look at my track record of consistency and my track record of all of the things that I've attempted to do, my careers have always held up, and it's solely for the purpose that I set out as a kid to be a soldier. I wasn't taking no for an answer. I had some challenges getting in the military, but I left high school right away. The second I finished high school, I was in the Army, and I spent 7 years in the Army. I got the opportunity to deploy to Bosnia as an artillery soldier. I had, you know, I challenged myself and did all kinds of crazy things that my body's feeling now. But halfway, or at the 7 year mark, I realized that I had an opportunity to transfer from the Army to the Air Force to become a firefighter. And that was truly the only way I was going to be able to be successful in that next part of my life, because I put a lot of faith in the military to educate me, because I struggled in normal academia. Like I struggled in school because of ADHD and just lack of motivation or commitment, whatever it is. So my years in school was not conducive to who I am today. my time in the military and the education I got from them is what makes me successful career-wise today. Because they put, a different spin on life, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, 100%. Yeah.
So I took the opportunity, I transferred to the Air Force and was a firefighter with them for 10 more years. And when I was 34, I kind of knew that I had to make the move to the municipal side. And that's when I was successful with getting on the city I'm on now. So really, I'm just doing the things that I love because I don't think I have a choice otherwise. Yeah.
So what did your, and I'm not sure, Wayne, if you were close with your parents and siblings growing up, but when you were like, I'm going to go into the military, were they like, I'm proud of my boy? Or what was the reaction?
See, this is, so I'm adopted. I was adopted as a baby. I think I was 8 weeks old when my mom and dad adopted me, and they're still together now. And I think because of the life that I had, and I had these two parents that just loved me more than anything in the world, and my sister, they loved us more than anything in the world, not because, I believe that they loved us as much as they did, and I hope that this doesn't come off wrong. I love my kids with all my heart, but I think when you adopt, it's a different kind of love. It's a full acceptance of not knowing why we feel the way we do. So our house wasn't built on politics. Our house wasn't built on religion. Our house was built on mental health. We were always facing challenges when it came to our mental health. So my parents saw that, and they knew that when I put something into my mind that I wasn't quitting until I got it. So they had no choice but to be happy and proud, and they truly are. They supported me from the beginning, and they support me now, and they know that what I'm doing, you know, for a living is because it is my purpose, you know. So I think I saw my dad cry once. I was getting ready to go back to Bosnia. I flew back to Canada for a couple of weeks for some leave. Mm-hmm. And our tours were 6-7 months long. So I flew home, spent a couple of weeks with my parents, and I was getting back on the plane to fly over, and my dad started to cry. And I only see my dad cry when Elvis sings, when Donny Osmond from Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat sings, which I can't explain. He's just a crier. And that time, you know, and it wasn't tears of sadness. It was, you could tell how proud he was. And I don't know where my wallet is, but I still remember the gate that I was standing at and that moment. So yeah, my parents have always supported me, even with this next part of my life. They are huge fans of who I am. Yeah.
So what's interesting, and I, you know, it's not a straight line in your career and life, as you said to me when I reached out to you and you were so gracious, was, mine's been not a straight line. And the other thing I believe in is just connections and how small of a world it really is. Like, so you're the, you know, out of 42 guests, you're the second one who's had a military background. It's also interesting, when did you go to Bosnia?
2000.
What year was that? 2000. Yeah. So this would have been later on, but two episodes ago, I had my brother-in-law, Igor Lukacs. And Igor's family was in Sarajevo, Bosnia, and ethnicity Serbian. And he came to Canada before he was 10, around in the early 90s, because of the war. Mm-hmm. And his parents had to start completely over. And it was really interesting to just hear what his parents instilled in him, and you know how tough they had it starting over in a new country, and how it impacted him. And because he was so young, he didn't think it had as much of an impact, but it was very interesting to see some of the things we uncovered.
Yeah. Oh, it's impossible for it to not. We're impacted. I think the impact of our life starts in utero, or that's what my therapist says. But to live through that in any capacity, and I've had the opportunity through my life to meet people who have moved to Canada from these countries that have faced tragedy and tragedy that most human beings, even the human beings that have gone there for 6 months, that have deployed there, that are military, we still cannot comprehend what has happened to these human beings. And I think that experience for me shaped my ability to judge other human beings. It shaped it in the sense that, I'm a human that gets upset when somebody's driving slow in front of me. I'm a human being that gets upset when I get cut off. You know, I don't I don't get all mad, but I feel that, and I want to rage at somebody sometimes, or I want to yell, but we don't know what they have gone through or what they have gone, their families have gone through. We don't know if they were, you know, refugees in Iran trying to get out of a country that's war torn, or from Afghanistan and their families have grown up, you know, living a life of uncertainty. So it's given me the opportunity to give other human beings and myself the benefit of the doubt, and give myself grace around, you know, the things that are happening in my everyday life that might not feel wonderful, but there is magic behind the statement that, you know, the grass is greener, but there's magic in the statement. We can cut that part out. You probably edit the shit out of this. There's magic in the statement that I forget the statement. There's just magic in the statements around it could be worse. That's what I was trying to say.
Oh, yeah. And what always impresses me with Igor and his family, especially his mother, I think of, she was an engineer, and, you know, engineering is something she was able to pick up here, is that none of the small stuff bothers her. And I think it's because of what they had to endure.
Yeah, life looks different. Life is different.
Well, as a Canadian, Wayne, thank you for your service. And I will ask before we move forward, is there anything you look back to on some of those times you went away as a learning that you still bring into your life today?
The power, first, I appreciate that. It's weird when people thank you for your service, because it's something that I had always wanted to do. I didn't do it for validation. It's one of the few things that, you know, that we do without the want of validation, is the things that we love. And I truly loved it. So I appreciate that. One of the blessings and curses that my career in the military has given me is that my brain is still very much there. I think about it every day. I think about what I've been through every day, and not with a victim's mentality, not at all, like with pride. However, there are things that, like, if we talked about with your brother-in-law, you said it's your brother.
Yeah, it's my brother-in-law. Yep.
I mean, he moved to Canada when he was 10, but those first 10 years had some power in the shape he is as a human now, you know, yeah. Or in how he is a human. And that 17 years I spent in the forces institutionalized me in a lot of ways. And we can talk about that, because, you know, in a bit, but because it institutionalizes you, it will always serve as a constant reminder. You know, I'm always thinking about the people that I served with. I'm also always thinking, did they like me? Do they like me now? Do they hate me? I'm in contact with all of the, a bunch of guys that are going through, you know, mental health struggles and journey. And that really makes me proud, because they're able to talk to me about things, and I'm able to talk to them about things. I rant, by the way. I go on little.
That's okay. I like it.
But yeah, no, I think that it plays a part in my everyday life, not always positive, but for the most part positive.
And I have to ask, do you think being in the military and some of those experiences you had lead to any of the mental health journey you've had, or do you think they're very disconnected? Does that make sense? The question?
It's a question that I ask myself daily. Mm. You know, it's, and I want to be really careful with how I shape this answer. When I joined the military, so in 1989, I was diagnosed with ADHD, ADD. Like I said, my family is very proactive when it came to mental health. So I was diagnosed really young in life, and I was medicated really young in life. And I was put on Ritalin. And I still remember, it was 30 milligrams a day. I still remember how I felt. I could tell you where the classroom was. And I still remember how it felt finally going to school and being able to spend a little bit more time focusing on the work that was put in front of me, or not, you know, having to move or fidget around or have this feeling that I couldn't describe at that time, but was anxiety. I still remember that. And when I was 17 and I was bent on, I needed to join the Army, I walked into the recruiting office and they, you know, they go through this checklist and they ask about medications. And I said, I'm on Ritalin. And they instantly said, I cannot join the military because I'm on Ritalin. You're not allowed to be on a stimulant or an ADD medication and serve in the Canadian Forces. So in order for me to join, I would have to be off the medication for a year. So I went home and I looked at my mom. I said, I'm done. I can't take Ritalin anymore. I want to join the Army. And I went back less than a year, lied to them, said I've been off a year, and I was in. And I remember getting to, you know, the basic training and the battle school part, and the struggle was real. And that struggle stayed till I was 40, till I went back on medication. And
so were you off medication that period?
For my entire military career.
Okay.
And I believe that with all of them, because I used to jump out of airplanes, I used to, you know, rappel out of helicopters, I used to be really close to a lot of things blowing up. That was my job, you know, and I loved it. But all of that stuff creates concussions. And when you have ADHD, it presents, you know, when you do brain scans, it presents a lot like traumatic brain injuries and concussions and the explosions and all those things didn't help, and they made the struggle even worse. So the military, as I loved it and I adored the people that I worked with and the leadership that I had, is why I'm successful today. I put a lot of praise in my success to the human beings that I've interacted with through my career in the forces. But I also hate it because it had a big hand in my wanting to take my life. It had a big hand in thinking that I wasn't good enough. It had a big hand in my constant search for validation. It had a big hand in my thinking that I'm not good enough because you're told you're not good enough, you know? So it's a love and not hate, but it's a love and it's a struggle sometimes, if that answers the question.
It certainly does. And can I just clarify, an artillery soldier, I believe you were.
Yeah.
What does an artillery soldier do or train to do?
So in every military, you have your combat arms, so your frontline soldiers. So you have your infantry, you have your tankers, you have your engineers that build bridges and blow things up. You have your artillery that does what we call, we use indirect fire. So our guns, they're called guns. They range between 80 millimeters and within mortars to 155 millimeters, which is our largest caliber, not using aircraft, but our largest caliber of weapon. And so I was on 105 millimeter and 155 millimeter howitzers, so big cannons that fire up to 40 kilometers away. And my job for 90% of my career in the artillery, only because I asked for it, I just said that's what I wanted to do. I was an observer. So I worked with the infantry and their direct fire support people. So I would get eyes on an objective or a target, and then working with three other people, we would be the eyes, and we would direct the guns 40 kilometers away or the fighter jets to drop bombs on the targets. So we would support the infantry in their ability to win a battle.
And you'd be on the ground doing that.
Oh yeah. I was right. We would either parachute in or rappel in. I never understood. We would fly in on helicopters sometimes, and they would drop us 13 hours away, and we would have to walk the rest. I'm like, this was a helicopter. Like, we could
seriously.
Yeah. We could have probably just flown a little bit. And I remember getting off the helicopter with like a ridiculous amount of gear on, my radio, and it would be, you know, we'd be doing exercises, and then we would walk for 13 hours, and the entire walk, because of my magical brain, would be like, why didn't you just bring us 12 hours closer? Like, you could have dropped us an hour away and nobody would have seen us. We could have gone in, done our thing, not be so tired, and had like a nice meal, maybe a shower when we get back. But no, you want us to walk all night to do something early in the morning to then walk home. It just never made sense.
Wow. And I wasn't laughing there, laughing at what you did. I'm just chuckling at you looking back on it like that. Yeah. And wow. Were you ever scared you might lose your life at times? Or does that not cross your mind when you're overseas in it?
So I was never in it. You know, like I mean, there were definitely hazards in Bosnia when I was there, but I was there after the war was over.
Yeah.
So our job was mostly to get displaced people back in their homes. We had, you know, we'd have arguments with the not so nice people over there, but that was the climax of my tour over there. When I think about all my friends that have gone to Afghanistan and have multiple tours in Afghanistan, I've asked them the same question and they all have the same answer. No, we're good if we die. It's not, that's every question you are asking opens up this massive dialogue. And it's kind of funny because in my career now, that's where things can get kind of intense, where you can have where death is on the table, you know, like there are things more so on the highway when we deal with highway calls, where there's more close calls than in fires. But death is this thing that I have battled with my entire life. And recently, the reason why I'm saying it's got such a huge dialogue is because I just opened up to my therapist 2 weeks ago. For the first time, I've told two people this in my life. Now I'm telling you and however many people listen to this. I can't wait to die. And that's a real crappy thing to say, but there's a reason. I have always had this massive narrative around my worth. And I find solace in dying for something bigger than me. I find solace I always joke around that, that's not really a joke, but I always say, I would love to die saving somebody else. And it's not a ruse. It's not, look at me go. You know, it's not a validation thing. And maybe that's why I've done the things that I've done for a living, because I, in a way, I feel like that's my that was going to be my legacy. I'm trying to change the narrative now. But I don't know if it was this thing that I put in the back of my head to make it okay if it ever happened, because they're inherently dangerous jobs. I don't know if it's a narrative that I put in my head because it feeds my dopamine and it gets my adrenaline going. And I don't know if it's a narrative in my head because of my mental health battles or adventures or journey. So I'm really at this place now where I'm trying to figure out that answer to that question, you know, because I've never been afraid. I've never been afraid to die, which is a weird thing to say without research too. A lot of people research it before. They're terrified to die. And then they watch near-death experiences on YouTube and find out that it's harmonious. And then they're like, okay, I'm not afraid anymore. No, I've never been afraid, ever.
Well, two things there, Wayne. One, I do have a lot of friends and people in my network that will listen to this that are Bosnian, Serbian, Croatian. So I want to clarify something. When you said the not-so-nice people, getting them back into their home, are you talking about there was a certain percentage that just didn't want to go and then weren't nice to the Canadian forces? Or
no,
were they the opposition of something or rebels of something?
So Bosnia was a really confusing one for me. When I was 19 or I was 19, 20 when I was there. And because when we look at conflict, we usually look at, you know, when we look at the entities or the races that are, or the culture, sorry, we look at entities or the cultures that are involved. And
yes,
and Bosnia was, you know, the Serbian, Croatians, and Muslims that really did not like each other. But every Serbian family we met was amazing. Every Muslim family we met was amazing. Every Croatian family that we met was amazing. The people that we had issues with, and I'll say it quite openly, I believe were the Russians that were within Bosnia still creating grief for us. You know, we were dealing with Russia had a really weird part in that place. I still have a business card and a picture, and I'll send it to you if you want to put it up.
Sure.
Mr. Vlado and Mr. Miro. And Mr. Vlado and Mr. Miro were from a company called Moto Commerce, and they were the only Russian people allowed on NATO camps. And they would take care of all of our foreign currency exchange, all of our hotels. If we got into the trouble with the police when we were in Croatia on leave or R&R, they were the ones that you called. And we're 99.99999% sure that these are Russian mafia people. But yet, so we patrolled, our area of responsibility was this area called Glamosh. And Glamosh was about an hour and a half drive from the camp. We lived in a town called Tomislavgrad. We called it TSG. And we would drive down to Glamosh to do all of our kind of patrolling and our work with the local people, because we would have families still living in blown out garden sheds, making us coffee in the morning, Yugoslavian coffee, and having conversations with us through our interpreter. And they would be smiling as they lived next to their blown out house in their what was once their garden shed and now is their home. The one lady witnessed her entire family shot, you know, in front of her, and they would be still, they would just be happy that there was people that cared about them and wanted to help them. But then we had a cafe that we frequented all the time. It ended up blown up and in the middle of the street one morning. And we weren't sure who did it. And very quickly, just because, you know, NATO has listens to everybody through electronic warfare. We had been in that country for over 10 years, so we knew what was going on. You know, it started as the UN and moved into a NATO deployment. And we quickly found out it was the Russians that did that. So our grief wasn't with the local population. Our grief and the only issues we ever had was with the Russian the Russian involvement in that country. That's why I think Ukraine is such a hard one for me. And I'm not here to talk about that stuff, but that I believe that's why Ukraine and, you know, other things is such a hard thing for me to watch now as a civilian, because I saw what happened over there. And I do want to say a big part of it was their responsibility at the end of the war. But the Bosnia people are amazing. Amazing.
Thank you. And, you know, if people watch the video after, if I throw it up, you know, I was getting a slightly emotional there. And I think as you were speaking, I was thinking of my brother-in-law's grandma, Bubba Vera, who I've met multiple times. She was just in Canada for 2 months, and she's back living in Novi Sad, Serbia. Amazing lady. She's in her 80s, if I have it right. And she still lived in Sarajevo in her apartment. They can correct me if I'm wrong, but up until like 5 years ago, I think. And my sister would go, and there was like a bomb mark on the side beside her patio on the back. It was just a condo or something, or a townhouse, I think. And I just started thinking what that lady's been through, and how she just told my sister, like, yeah, I was in my house and that hit, and it is what it is. And then I started thinking about my niece and nephew who, you know, my niece is 4 and she speaks fluent Serbian and can go back and forth between English and Serbian, and how that's their great grandmother, and they're going to learn a lot about that. And I think that's going to be really positive. And it's also hard sometimes to learn about the history. So
I think that it plays a massive role in the way that the earth is spinning right now. And I mean that in the sense that as human beings, we sit here and we watch through screens all of these conflicts that are going on around the world. And we protest on the streets in Toronto about, you know, this. And we protest on the streets of in Germany and in England. We protest all over the world about what these human beings are going through, and what genocide looks like, and what, you know, internal cleansing looks like, and war crimes look like. And I remember the smells of what genocide is. And I remember the smells of what a country that has been through conflict based on a belief system. I remember what it smells like. But I mostly remember, more than anything, I remember your Baba.
It's my brother-in-law's Baba, which is his grandma.
I remember the Babas.
Yeah,
I remember the women. I remember I don't remember the men. I don't remember the children. And I know that sounds bad. I remember the women that were over 50, that were over 60, that were so passionate about their culture that's all that mattered was rebuilding and living and spending their life moving forward, teaching like they would speak of the tragedy and travesties that happened with the most calm, cool, and collected demeanor possible. They would sit and tell you about this one lady. She said, and I believe she was Serbian. I think Glamosh was a Serbian town. It might have been, I'm not sure. I don't know, so I don't want to speak out of turn. But the enemy, their enemy, at that time showed up at their house and said that, you know, the enemy was coming pretending to be as, you know, their same religion or belief system, and you need to get your family and you need to get in your car and you need to get out of here because they're coming. So she got her family, they packed up, they got in the car, and they shot them, and they drove their car off the side of a cliff. And you would see this area we used to patrol was known for its potato growth. And I believe at one time they were supplying like a bunch of potatoes for McDonald's. So, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, wow, we're eating these McDonald's fries from this place where it is now littered at the bottom of this cliff with cars, some that missed the switchbacks because the roads are really wet, but most because that's how they were disposed of. You know, in Sarajevo, you would drive down where the Olympics were, and there would be buildings cemented off, probably next to Bubba's building, that had a mass grave of over 5,000 people in it. You know, wow. but yet, she lived through that and still lives and is able to find some sense of calm in what has happened. So I say to your Baba, Dobardan Kakoste. Because that's all I remember, really.
I'll pass that on to Igor and his family, and they will pass it on to their Baba Vera. And
yeah,
you know, this summer in Burlington, Ontario, she was holding her, you know, 5-month-old great grandchild. And yeah. How cool is that?
Unreal. Make sure that, I don't mean to interrupt, make sure if you haven't had it, make sure you have Slivovitz.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which we called it slip in the ditch. we would have these shots, and
yeah,
you could never say no, and it would be around this fire, and the man would be like, you want shot of Slivovitz. So you would have this shot, and then the one day we took a shot, and the driver of our armored personnel carrier that we would travel around in, she had one shot and it messed her up, and she slammed into a Portuguese army convoy going the opposite way of us driving back to camp. So yeah, no, it's a good, it's plum brandy.
It's plum. Yeah. Or they call it, Arakia. You ever heard that term?
No,
that's Arakia. Arakia. You know what I'll try and do maybe sometime is, maybe sometime after this, we'll get some of that out to you.
I have a bottle. I have a,
there you go.
I have a bottle. I got it in Croatia when I was there, like 9 years ago.
It's harsh stuff, but
yeah,
you know, Wayne, even the podcast called It's Not a Straight Line. I had no idea we were going to get into that conversation, and thank you for sharing. And I want to ask you, so then you've done firefighting. Are you still a firefighter?
Yeah, I'm still a firefighter.
City of Pickering, I believe. How did you get into content creation and comedy and humor?
Yeah, this is my
jam. That's what we want to talk about today.
This is what I like to talk about. The army stuff is hard. I loved it. But I just feel like, because I tell so many military stories all the time, mostly the funny ones. I'm not sitting here trying to be the ghost Rambo. I was kind of like Rambo, a little bit like Rambo, but like I was more like Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam. And I truly mean that. So when I was in the Army, I just transferred to the Air Force. I got posted to the West Coast of Vancouver Island. And on top of my always wanting to be a soldier and a fireman, I also always wanted to be a comedian. My dream was to be on Saturday Night Live. Moreover, my dream was to be on Mad TV. And
oh, nice.
That was like my ultimate goal was to be this. I wanted to be famous. I did.
Was that like Carrot Head on that show or something? The big,
yeah,
I think I'm wrong.
No,
Mad TV show.
Could have been in Living Color, but I think so. Right. I think of Mad TV. I think of my friend's wife and Stuart's mom.
All right.
But, so I walked into a bar, and this was when Last Comic Standing was on NBC. I walked into a bar in Comox, BC, on Vancouver Island. It was called the Mex Pub. And I went in and I got a job there as a bartender. And I sucked at making drinks. I lasted 2 days. But in that, I looked at the owner. I said, you should let me do a Last Comic, Comox Valley's Last Comic Standing. You should let me do a stand-up comedy competition. I'll get all the... And I did. I put this thing together, and I got on stage, and I hosted this thing, and I started writing jokes, and I would perform a little bit, and I would write more jokes, and I would perform, and I was just, it would feed me. It made me, I don't know, it just took everything that was in my brain that was in, like, that was this overthought brain process that I have, and I would just turn it into self-deprecation, and I would turn it into laughs, and it worked. But it worked for me. It did something for me. So I ended up moving to Victoria a couple years later because I had to sail with the Navy for 3 years. As a firefighter, you spend 3 years on ships. And I started doing stand-up with these at this local bar in Victoria called Heckler's Pub. And I hosted there for a couple years. And when I was not away at sea, I would do stand-up at this bar. And I would meet comics that were in, you know, that did the Just for Laughs festival. They were Yuck Yucks comics, and I started doing more comedy. And I got to a place where I was starting to get established as a stand-up, where there was, you know, times where my brain thought, okay, maybe you can leave the military and you can go try stand-up for real. And I just kept, it was safe to stay in the military. It was safe to not, you're paid every 2 weeks. I wasn't the best at money. I was in my late 20s and it was safe. So it was 2009. I deployed to Somalia for 7 months to do anti-piracy. So we were chasing some Somalian pirates in the Gulf of Aden for 7 months. And I was at sea, and I missed comedy. I just missed writing jokes. I missed these shows. I missed what it did for me. It didn't pay anything. I wasn't missing money. Like, I made maybe $100 that paid for the night, but there was something missing in me. So I walked up. We had every morning when the ship wakes up at 7 a.m, the weather technologist comes on, and they come on to the ship's intercom system, and it goes throughout the ship, and they'd be like, good morning, HMCS Winnipeg. The weather today in the Indian Ocean is 85 degrees. Soup will be at 10. I believe it's French onion soup. And I'm like clawing my ears out listening to this. They'd be like, okay, to finish this up, knock, knock, who's there? Interrupting cow, intro to moo. And I'd be like, I can't do this. So I walked up to the bridge. I said, listen, I have a specific set of skills to make human beings laugh. And I could do way better than any weather person can. So I would like to do a morning show every single day on this deployment. They said, sure, go for it.
Wow.
So I would stay. We had crappy internet. You're in the middle of the Indian Ocean. We have crappy internet. We're still doing our regular duties and stuff. But I would stay up every night till like 10, 11 o'clock because I would be trying to get the sports scores. We had the ability to watch sports on TV for people that watch sports. I didn't watch. I'm not a sports person. I don't sport at all. We had a brief conversation about that. But I would stay up and I would sit on the internet, just wait for it to load the scores, and I'd write the scores down. And then I would, you know, put that in my show. Then at that time, do you remember the Chuck Norris jokes?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
So I had a book of Chuck Norris jokes, and I took all of the Chuck Norris out and I replaced it with our coxswain. Now, the coxswain is responsible for the discipline on the ship. And our coxswain's name was Dave Bliss, and he was tattooed from neck to knuckle. And he was the hardest soldier, sailor, all things I've ever met in my career. And I adore him till this day. And, you know, he liked me. I don't know why, because I was a pain in the ass. I was always joking around. I was always a clown. But he liked me because I worked hard, or I pretended to work hard. I don't know what it was, but I would replace the jokes with him, and I'd be like, they tried to find, you know, they wanted to put the coxswain's face on a coin, but they couldn't find a metal hard enough for his mustache. Just little things like that. And this grumpy guy, even though he'd be at a different part of the show, I could almost feel him giggle when it came on. You know, I just included everybody in the ship. I made everybody feel like a human for that 2 or 3 minutes.
And it wow.
How bad of a day you were having, especially for me, I just got that 2 or 3 minutes of just joy and laughter and people coming, oh, that was funny, you know, or thank you for the sports scores, or thank you for the song. And it gave me this validation that I am onto something when I look at being a comedian or a humorist, as I call myself now. But there's power in it. There's just this power for me and for power for the people that are in front of you and that you make laugh. I don't know where I was going with that, but
no, that was brilliant. You know what's cool about that? Like, you took a situation where you're on this ship for 7 months. I can't even imagine what that's like.
Awesome.
And you were like, I can't take this in the morning. And I have a skill set, and I'm going to do something about it, damn it.
Yeah.
And then you impacted a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't know what it was. I just feel like we have to do those things. If you have to have impact in whatever it is that you're doing. It doesn't matter if you are a greeter at Walmart or a neuroscientist in the world's craziest neuroscience-y place. You have to impact other human beings. One, it makes it so when you're in a bad mood, they forgive you easier. But most importantly, it feeds your soul. It, looking back at it, you know, and what I know about energy and vibrations and frequencies and stuff like that now, which is not very much, but it's felt. And it's felt throughout, you know, in that case, it was felt throughout the ship. Even the people that were annoyed by Wayne had a little bit of a giggle. I ended that trip with bringing Russell Peters to...
No way.
Yeah, so...
I've met Russell once or twice from GFL. Yeah.
So Russell Peters, a buddy of mine, he's still a close friend of mine. He was a cook on board and he was one of my biggest fans. He came to every stand-up comedy show I did. He still remains one of my closest friends, but he comes up to me and he goes, listen, I'm going to try to get the Tragically Hip to come perform on this ship. Listen, what are you doing? He goes, yeah, it's a thing, but I'm going to try. We have this budget for entertainment.
Nice.
He says, well, I'm going to get Russell Peters to come to the ship. And he goes, yeah, but you don't know Russell Peters. I said, no, I know. I'll figure it out. So I go onto that computer where the internet is shit. I find his manager's email, which was Clayton, his brother.
His brother, yeah.
And I send him, hey, listen, I'm this guy. This is what I do. This is my experience in stand-up. We're just finishing up a 7-month deployment, you know, where we actually made a record. We were away from land for the longest since like the Second World War or something.
Wow.
And, you know, I laid it all out. And I said, we would love to have Russell perform on the ship. And he got back to me. And he goes, well, he's in South Africa at this time. I said, well, we're in Africa at this time, so maybe we can meet up there. And we talked about Singapore and all these places. Finally agreed to meet us in Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
So we came alongside in Pearl Harbor, and Russell, his brother, his brother's wife, and his fiance at the time, who's now his ex-wife, his daughter's mom. They flew in. I met them at Waikiki Beach and we hung out that night, got to know each other. Then we brought them out to the ship. We performed, you know, he brought a local Hawaiian comic, brought him out to the ship. He performed. My mind was blown this whole time. There's pictures of us and I'm just like, still, at that. I'm going like, what did I do? I can't believe I did this. I followed through. I was consistent. I made it happen. At the end of the show, Russell's brother comes up to me and he says, hey, do you you want to come back with us to the hotel? And I'm like, nah, I'm just really tired. I'm just going to go to the pub with some of my buddies. I didn't want to impose, right?
Yeah, of course.
To find out, to be made known, because they didn't fight me on it. They're like, okay, have a great night. We had a wonderful time. The next day I get an email from his brother and it's like, oh, you missed a night. Russell Peters' best friend is the bass player for No Doubt.
No way.
And No Doubt and the Black Eyed Peas played that night and they went to an after party. And that's basically where I think I was getting invited to. But I decided to go to the local Moose McGillicuddy's with my two buddies and drink shitty beer, you know? So,
hey, you got to stick to your truth, man. That's what you wanted to do.
Gwen Stefani and I almost became a couple that night, but the universe works in mysterious ways.
That's amazing. Are you just like, yeah, I don't know. I'll figure it out. See what I can do. That's so good. Did he ever get the Tragically Hip?
No, I don't even think he emailed them.
Are you a Hip fan?
I am a Hip fan.
Yeah. Well, I know you're a big, we talked off record, you know, you support the Princess Margaret Cancer Foundation. So
I do.
If we ever have Paul Langlois, the guitarist, one of the guitarists, we ever have Paul Langlois Blatt back at Road Hockey to Conquer Cancer as a celebrity, we'll make sure you come out if you'd like to meet Paul.
Oh, I think that would be fantastic.
We keep saying to, well, through my other contact, we keep saying to Paul, can you bring Rob Baker too? And the drummer, Rob Baker's the guy with the long hair.
Yeah.
And I went to Queens for a year and he would always hang out in front of his house with his two huskies and everyone knew him in town. They're just great people.
Hey, Canadian musicians are great people. Yeah. Great people. There's a lot of that around here with Blue Rodeo being from the area.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So
quick Russell Peters story. He always would come to Just for Laughs and support it. He's friends with my former boss, Bruce Tills. And there would be events at a hotel in Montreal. I won't say it on here. They were always events where we would invite all the top sponsors, the top people, the comedians. A lot of them would just come hang out. It was great. One night I was there and is it Pete Davis on SNL? Pete Davis.
Pete Davidson.
Who did he date? Ariana Grande at one point, or was it Selena Gomez?
So he probably was just, all of them.
He was there with some of his buddies just hanging out on the patio. This was when he was very new at SNL. And I'm like, who's that? They're like, it's Pete Davidson. I'm like, oh, cool. And now he's become such a big star. And but Russell loves DJing too. And so there was a DJ at the event and we're all hanging out and there's probably 200 to 250 people. And next thing you know, by 1:30, Russell's like just slowly nudging the DJ off and he just took over. And I was like, oh my God, this is great.
Yeah, he is a talented human being. Yeah, I would love to scratch records.
You should, with him. So speaking of talented, how did you come up with this Good Morning Assholes, create this content on Instagram, TikTok, and what other, as my editor and my coach of podcasts says, whatever other evil social medias are out there, how did you just start that Good Morning Assholes? And then you had merch, you had a coffee cup.
Yeah. And I don't know how any of it happened. During the pandemic, TikTok, I was introduced to TikTok by my boss at work, actually. He's like, he's this 50-something year old at the time. And he goes, Wayne, you got to check this out, you'll laugh. And I just remember scrolling and it was just funny video after funny video after funny video. And ended up, I just started creating, you know, funny little clips. And I was doing them, I scroll back on my phone because with ADHD, you don't delete anything. And I scrolled back 18,900 pictures on my phone and would find these videos on 2017, 2018, me just talking to my phone and making these little videos, kind of like what I do now. And I wouldn't put them anywhere. I didn't put them on the internet. That wasn't what they were for. They were for me. And I was going through it, man. I think in 2021 is when I started doing April 2021. I believe April 4th was the first Good Morning Assholes I ever posted. And it came after me treating myself like an asshole for the last however many years. I had my last, dark hole that I went into. It was December of 2020. And when I got out of that, I had said, you know, quit treating yourself like shit. Tell yourself you love yourself in the mirror every day. And, you know, stop being an asshole to yourself, essentially. And I just woke up one morning. I was like, good morning, asshole. Or good morning, assholes. Because I feel like we all treat ourselves like assholes. We think everybody else is treating us like assholes, but it's actually us treating ourselves like assholes.
That's right.
So I did it, and then it felt good. Just like the morning show felt good, man. And then I did it again. It felt good. And then I got a little bit of traction. I was like, what's happening? People were liking this. Some people were like, don't call me an asshole. And then they would disappear. But then more people would be like, I love it. And then I would go on Google and I would find these little quotes. And I would say, good morning, assholes. You know, be the pink starburst, not the whatever. And I'm like, no, I can't use other people's quotes. I got my own quotes. And I don't like sitting Googling stuff. So I just started coming up with my own stuff. And it felt good. And it got more traction, and it felt even better, and it felt better and better. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm getting recognized outside the house. I'm going
out.
Wow. I'm meeting these, you know, I'm having these famous people that follow me on TikTok, like my celebrity crush and I became friends on TikTok, Alyssa Milano. And I'm like, what the fuck? And these people are reaching out and saying, you know, like, what you're doing is helping me. Like you said at the beginning, there was something about just, I'm not trying to coach anybody or give advice. I'm just trying to resonate with people. I'm talking to myself in the mirror. I'm not talking to you assholes. I'm talking to this asshole, you know, and then more and more things kept coming my way with it. And it was feeding my soul, and it was feeding my soul. And I had always wanted to do a podcast. I thought it was wonderful. So I had reached out to, I started a friendship with Alex from his NAF podcast.
Yeah.
And I was actually going to interview him.
Okay.
And then I said, fuck it. Let's just do a podcast, man. So we started ZenAF, and his wife, and this is how it all comes together. His wife is Mo Collins, so Stuart's mom from Mad TV.
No way.
And we became really close friends. We talk, you know, like we send messages back and forth. We've kind of gone our separate ways because we live different lives. But, you know, next thing you know, I go down to Austin to meet them. And I just love those human beings so much. But she was a massive part of my wanting to be who I am becoming now. You know, well before, in the 90s, well before she knew who I was. And now I can say that, you know, she's a decent friend of mine. And things like that kept happening. And ZenAF started doing well. And I would meet more people that wanted to see me succeed. And every time I've wanted to walk away from it because it hasn't, you know, because it's social media. It's a nasty place. Yes. I don't think I've ever actually received a negative comment for my content, but it gets hard. It gets challenging trying to come up with new things every day and then have the throes of normal life come in and you have to pretend that you're happy. And I was like, I'm not going to pretend I'm happy. I'm also going to make these things when I'm sad. I'm going to make these things when I'm angry. I'm going to make these things when I hurt, because I'm not here to pretend that this world is sunshine and rainbows. I'm here to show that this world has struggle, and that the reason we take medication is important. The reason why we have these lows are important and they're powerful. You know, I am trying to prove to myself that the struggle is worth it. And it comes out the best when I speak it externally, you know? So when Zen AF stopped, it was hard on me because I was like, well, there goes my podcast dreams.
How many episodes did you guys do?
We did around 70. We were 18 months weekly.
Wow.
We were top 100 in all of the countries for a while. But ultimately, you know, when you're with somebody who, you said it too, you said, you know, like you have always wanted to be a speaker and you've always wanted to do these things, and they weren't motivated by money because you had the ability, you know, you had that day to day, you had the ability to do both and to really, and that's what you need to make it in this game. You know, you need 5 solid years of commitment to doing this as a hobby with the hopes that it will give you the ability to do it for a living, right? Alex never had that. Alex was looking for and is looking for his next job because he's an actor, he's an entertainer.
Yes.
He's so when it wasn't making money, we felt it. We felt that energy. And he just wasn't interested anymore. And then I lost interest. I thought I was done. I thought that my podcast was only doing good because I asked Alex to be a part of it. It was my idea, you know, and I don't say that with an ego. I brought it to him. Like I wanted this podcast, and I kept saying every day after that, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do a podcast. I'm going to do a podcast. I'm going to do a podcast. 2 years. And I got into the throes of addiction with cannabis. Mm-hmm. And it buried me into my chair. And that's why I haven't been seen that much for the last couple of years. And I took a break from that and I just started creating Mindfulish. I rant about this because it comes back to one thing. Nobody that supported me or has supported me, nobody when it comes to my friends, nobody when it comes from these celebrities that I've never met face to face that believe in me. Nobody when it comes to, you know, Dean Blundell was a big fan or is a big fan of the content that I create and has always left an open door for me, even though he called me out last week when we had a meeting about me going into his network because he's wanted me in his network and he wanted Zen in his network. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen. So his fears around me being consistently inconsistent are still there. But none of these people have stopped believing in me. When I want to throw it away, when I want to quit it, when I want to walk away from it, when I want to just sell all this stuff and not do it, somebody will walk up to me at the gym and say, hey, you're that Good Morning Assholes guy. And I just want to let you know that you helped me get through postpartum. Or, hey, you're the Good Morning Assholes guy. And I've got terminal cancer and you're helping me laugh through it. And this happens all over the world. When my girlfriend and I travel, people come up to me still.
Wayne, what do you have going on? And when you said you weren't seen as much for 2 years, do you mean you weren't seen like physically on video on TikTok, or do you mean you weren't being seen by others?
No, I wasn't. I dropped off. I would create very little. I would have all these wonderful ideas. I met this group of people in Peterborough that are unreal in the cinematography world, that are unreal in the creation of all things moving with cameras. And they would set up all their equipment and we would try to film an episode of Mindfulish. And we have all these ideas for Mindfulish that I wanted, or I would have all these ideas for Mindfulish, and they would have, you know, they would have these wonderful additions to the ideas, and they wanted to help and they wanted to do it, but I just could not create authentically. I could not get what I wanted to say out, and it would make me recluse. I would suck back into, you know, the throes of the chair, and I would just sit and think about all these things I want to do, but not do any of them. And I would listen to all of the things, man, all of the podcasts that say, you just got to do it. You just got to pull the trigger. You know, you just got to create. You just have to. And I'd be like, I know. Okay, I'm going to do it. I got this, man. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to make it. And then I would sit and I'd be like, I don't know what to say. And then I heard one guy say this. He said, it's got to be ugly at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't mean from a production standpoint, or I didn't interpret it to be from the production standpoint. It resonated. And it resonated in the sense that my purpose is to not heal human beings. My purpose is to not coach, give advice, do anything like that for human beings. My purpose is to let human beings see what it looks like to grow from somebody who has had an insane life, and we haven't even scratched it, man. I need people to see Wayne as advertised. And I'm out there right now with Mindfulish, and it's all over the place, but there's a method. It's all over the place because that is truly how my brain is thinking.
Yeah.
It's all over the place because it needs to start messy.
Yep.
I need to be seen. I don't need to be seen by millions of people. I need to be seen by one person, and that is me. So when I say that I haven't been seen, it's not by the external. It's just I have not been around. I haven't been doing it, but I'm back. Oh, I'm back.
And it's, oh, Wayne's back. So Wayne, sexy. Where can people find you? I know on TikTok with Good Morning Assholes. You can tell us if you're still posting. You've got over 230,000 followers, I think, there. You've got your YouTube page. I think you just have to look up Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E, and then Hannah is H-A-N-N-A-H, or should they look up Mindfulish?
They can look up Mindfulish. They can look up Wayne Hannah. I'm most of my stuff is on Instagram right now. It's all cross-pollinated. And the evil things, but Instagram is a good place to find me as we build out a more beautiful spot for people to just find and click on me. YouTube is what I am focusing on right now.
Yeah,
you'll be able to find Mindfulish on all the podcast places very shortly. I'm not really good at pumping my stuff. That's where I suck.
Okay.
I'll pump
your tires in some social posts as we get this out, because, you know, I started this podcast and I had a similar thing to what you said. I was like, hey, can I impact one listener? And it's grown beyond that. But if we do everything and we're just like, can we impact one person? At least for me, that's good enough. I can go to bed at night and be cool with it. So Wayne, thank you for being a part of this. I have three quick hitter questions. I call them zigzag questions because it's not a straight line.
Okay.
So you can answer these with one word or a quick phrase. What keeps you waking up in the morning and wanting to create this content?
It feeds my soul. Truly feeds my soul.
Feeds my soul. Without, because this could be a podcast in itself, but what is a learning from your mental health journey that you'd share?
That the greatest gift you can give yourself is grace.
Grace. I've been trying to give myself a lot of grace lately.
And it doesn't have to be pretty. Grace can just, grace is as powerful as telling the people around you that you're not having a good day, and that you need to not have a good day, and you need to not be judged for that. When we give ourselves grace, we also give the human beings around us grace. We give them the opportunity to have a narrative, even if there is no narrative to how we feel. Most of my mental health stuff, there's no narrative.
I love that, grace. Such a powerful word we don't think about a lot. Mm-hmm. And finally, when you first took the chance to do stand-up and to get on that stage, or to say to that person on the ship, I want to do this in the morning, what advice would you give to someone, short advice would you give to someone who wants to try, say, stand up or something that's very scary that they might fail at?
We only fail at the things we don't try again. Failure is only, you know, we're unsuccessful at a lot of things, but the things we fail are the things that we don't ever approach again. And just do it when you know you'll do it when it's right for you. Right. If you talk about something that you're going to do something for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and you don't do it, doesn't mean you're never going to do it. So just trust in your process. If it is going around in your head constantly, there will be a time that you attempt it. It might feel like you're never going to do it. If you play guitar, that you're never going to learn this song. If you want to be a comedian, that you're never going to stand up on a stage. It doesn't mean it's never going to happen. It's just not right now. So give yourself grace. But ultimately, you got to do it. Even if you suck at it, because it has to start ugly.
Yeah. Someone wise once said on this podcast, it's got to be messy at the beginning.
It's got to be messy at the beginning.
Thank you so much, Wayne.
Oh, I appreciate you, man. Yeah.
I appreciate you. What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it. You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.